You are listening to the Women Offshore Podcast. I'm Christine McMillan, filling in for Ali Cedinho while she is on maternity leave. I'm an experienced mariner and the program coordinator here at Women Offshore. Women Offshore is a 501c3 nonprofit organization supporting a diverse workforce on the water. New episodes of the Women Offshore Podcast are available every Tuesday. Subscribe on whatever platform you like to listen to podcasts on and be in the know about the latest topics related to diversity, equity, and inclusion within the maritime and offshore industries. Be inspired by the stories shared here. Thank you to the OGGN for their continuous support as our podcast producer. They have the best energy shows on their network. Hi there, this is Christine, and I have Bryce Lawrence with us today. I am very excited to let him introduce himself. I am virtually meeting with him. I'm sitting in my home in Colorado, and thanks to technology, Bryce is across the world. Bryce, where are you calling in from? And please introduce yourself.
So I'm actually a Kiwi, a New Zealander living in Hamburg, Germany. So I've been here about 9 years now. About coming up a year ago, I came up with an idea for a new startup to work on my areas that I'm passionate about, as helping people and trying to do some good in the world. And so I started up a venture called ESG Ship Vetting.
Awesome. So tell us more about what ESG means to you and how you came up with this idea.
So ESG is a term for sustainability, another term for sustainability, or another term for corporate social responsibility. It has a number of meanings. In the finance world, it's got one meaning, but in the rest of the world, it's got more traditional corporate social responsibility, sustainability. So the ESG stands for environment, social, and governance. So it's talking about having good environmental practices, good social practices, and good governance to basically be a good corporate citizen. And so I'm trying to introduce the concept to my clients around, if you're going to be shipping goods around the world, maybe you should be paying attention to the ships that carry your cargo. We're doing supply chain due diligence for our factories in China, our factories in Bangladesh, our coffee growers in South America, and also other forms of modern slavery, and also in our own countries. Like here in Germany, we take care of our workers through workers' rights. But there's a gap in the middle that nearly every supply chain uses. It's the ships. And no one's really paying attention to the human rights issues that are aboard ship.
So what we're really talking about today is that missing link to seafarer welfare.
Yeah, so we say we're the missing link. You know, everyone's doing supply chain or value chain due diligence and looking from A to Z, but somehow they're missing that middle part. And so, you know, what we're talking about is the missing link in supply chain due diligence.
So the reason that we're having this conversation with the women offshore community is that, you know, we care about human rights and our life and on board a ship. And so I think that you and your organization dovetails so well into our mission of making the seas a safer place for everyone. And so tell me more about your strategic advisor, Frank Coles, and really how you're getting this organization off the ground.
So yeah, about a year ago, I started searching for a business partner. And I was shoulder tapping on a few people, calling them up and saying, hey, are you interested? And they were all about, yeah, I'm happy to sell you my services. And no, I'm actually looking for someone to help with the concept and bring another skill set into the organization. And I just saw this guy, Frank Coles, online, and he was advocating for seafarer rights and seafarer welfare. And I just said, hey, Frank, do you want to have a chat? And it turns out, yeah, Frank, he was the former chief executive of the Wallam Group, which is one of the larger ship management and crew management companies in the world based in Hong Kong. And he resigned in, I think, December 2019. And one of the reasons he's resigned, it's not the only reason, he resigned because of COVID issues, also being separated from his wife, but he also mentioned that he was unhappy with being the chief executive of a ship management company and crew management company, and not able to, as a mariner himself, deliver the working conditions that he believed all seafarers deserved. and it became a bit of an issue for him. And when he left, he was quite passionate about making some positive movement for the industry, for the seafarers. And as an insider, he's got a lot to share, and he got some pretty strong words of discouragement from the industry. And if you do this, you'll never work in the industry again. And Frank, he's a pretty strong bloke. And he said, well, I'm doing it. And this was before him and I had a conversation. He actually threw the idea out there of having a general strike of seafarers to drive a point home, because it seems that there is no organization that has the ability to actually make a difference. And during COVID, it was absolutely appalling, the amount of time people spent at sea in horrendous conditions, never stepping foot on shore for months, if not a year at a time. And Frank was pretty passionate about this. And so he said, yeah, I'll help you out. And so we sat down. We did a podcast ourselves, actually, together. I interviewed him. And then he agreed that he's going to help me out with ESG shipbuilding.
That's great. And so Frank sounds like he's really passionate about this topic, as do you. And I mean, I think that a lot of us, you know, I come from a maritime background as well. I shipped out for 8 years and went to sea, and I was working on American flagships. And some days when, you know, the salad bar ran low, we would get upset that our lettuce wasn't as fresh as it should be. You're not talking about those issues. Like, can you describe for us what type of protections you're attempting to keep people safe?
Well, I mean, it's an open secret that crew don't get treated very well on board these ships. The industry has been trying to address it, and the leaders of the industry are acknowledging there's a problem, but somehow the industry isn't able to address issues such as, you know, forced overtime, logbooks that show the maximum allowed hours per day, but the crew doing more hours than that, easily more than that. Little or no access to medical treatment. Even before COVID, limited access to shore in some ports around the world. You know, inadequate nutrition. I mean, I did a podcast with one guy, and he explained how, you know, his mates were sharing stories. They had to buy drinking water in the ports from basically scalpers. The ship owner or the charterer or whoever was responsible wouldn't pay for a clean drinking system on board the vessel and wouldn't supply clean drinking water. So they purchased bottled water in the ports at exorbitant prices. They also would be having to buy food in the ports so they had adequate nutrition on board. And then you've got the crew abandonment issues, where crews don't get paid for months at a time. And then when they force the ship owner's hands, the ship owner just abandons the ship where it is. And they're stuck on board for months, if not years, until the legal battle between the country where the ship's been abandoned and the owners or whoever, charities or other governments, get involved to help the crew out. Crews, you know, during the COVID pandemic, crews being forced to sign documents that they were voluntarily staying on board for another 9 month rotation, which that was illegal, but they did it. You know, I talk to guys that have said, you know, this is the horrible part about it. Even on board, we talk about, you know, we see on the news with the Ukraine-Russian crisis how the crews on board, the ships, the Russian crews and the Ukrainian crews find it difficult. They get on fine. They don't buy into it. But somehow there's still a class system on board some vessels where you've got Eastern European officers and Asian crew members. Mm-hmm. And Eastern European officers have full internet access, but they turn their access off to the Asian crew members. One, maybe just to control them, mind games, power games, or maybe it's just so they have better bandwidth themselves. You know, that sort of stuff is just, it's horrid that you've got these people working for us, spending years, at the moment, years away from home, not stepping foot on shore for long periods, and they don't have access to talk to their families. I mean, I talked to one guy, sometimes you cannot talk to your family for 3 to 4 to 6 months.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
That's insane. And, you know, I can't get my head around how in modern ports around the world, seafarers don't have access. So put aside the supposed internet issues on board ships, the owners don't want to pay for satellite communications. but how they can come into port and then have to go and buy a SIM card to be able to call their family. And they need a seafarer charities to help them buy a SIM card. How do we live in a world where we are fully connected, but the crew members can't get Wi-Fi in a port?
Right. Yeah, that's insane. It's crazy to think that.
The industry's missing some empathy for their critical workers. And I can guarantee I can guarantee the white owners of these vessels aren't going to go on a business trip and not have any communications. They will spend per day on data roaming packages quite a lot of money to have data roaming. And they're only gone for maybe a week at a time. And they have comms with their family all the time. They have business comms. But these guys who are actually doing the hard yards have limited access. It's improving. And there's been all these recent changes to IMO guidelines around improving access. But you know, it's sad that you need to pass an IMO resolution to encourage better access for a global fleet of ships. I mean,
right. It should be a common denominator that everyone is able to have equal access to communications. And so how do you hold companies' feet to the fire? I mean, we all know that, you know, money speaks, right? And so can you tell us more about Article 18 and, you know, what does that mean and how are you able to actually make an impact?
So our target clients are not the shipping industry. We don't provide services to the shipping industry. We provide services to the shippers, the cargo owners, and also banking facilities who provide loans to ship owners. So here in the EU, the European Union, we have what's called the EU taxonomy, and there's Article 18 where it says do no harm. So the EU taxonomy is all actually about anti-greenwashing. So if you're investing in something and claiming it's a green investment, or you're selling green investments, you've got to prove it's green. And it's mainly focused around climate change and so forth, and some other high-level environmental goals. But there's a catch-all in there called Article 18, which says do no significant harm. And then it refers to the UN guidelines and also for the OECD guidelines for multinational companies. And they're talking about basically human rights as a plus the other environmental topics. And basically it says you've got to look at the impact of your business, not just what is the environmental impact of the ship that I build, but how is it operated? It's the whole chain of your business, your loan, and what the other effects that your industry might create. So if I finance a ship, does the owner care about human rights on board his ship? Does he have systems in place? How do I prove that my investment is green and not causing significant harm? So the general EU taxonomy is talking about if you're going to claim green, which is a positive, you've got to prove it's positive, but also you've got to catch all saying do no significant harm. So the EU is talking about bringing in other control measures to, if you want to say you're acting good socially or from a human rights perspective, you've got to prove it. But at the moment, there's this catch-all saying, if you're going to claim green, you've got to do no harm. And that talks about human rights. How do you prove that? Well, you've got to do due diligence and you've got to check. So typically a bank, from my experience, I've worked in the oil and gas industry in the past, we were raising funds and we had to provide them evidence that we were doing good practice. Another set of guidelines called the International Finance Corporation guidelines and other things like quota principles and other standards. And they would ask us questions and we would demonstrate good practice at the start. But then the EU taxonomy refers to UN guidelines and the OEC guidelines. And they actually said, well, once you've done your due diligence at the start, you've got to check that your investment is doing, the person you lend the money to is actually delivering. So it's not just a paper-based tick box at the start of the process. It's about, are they living up to the terms of your contract with them?
Okay. And is that a part of what your organization is doing, is helping prove and vet these standards to make sure that they are?
Yeah. So for a financial institute, first of all, it's about having a plan in place and a policy in place to implement the EU taxonomy Article 18. So it's about asking for the right information up front before you give them the loan. Because once you've got a loan contract, if there's nothing in there for them to check, they're powerless. So it's about having a policy about what is our minimum standards, what we ask of the companies that we loan money to who are building ships and running ships. And then we, if they want our support, we will help them develop a human rights policy for their loans. We will also help them draft contract conditions that will mean they can put into effect their contract conditions, because there's no point saying comply with the guideline if you've got no ability to assess it. And then, yeah, then we offer the services also of auditing on their behalf against their contract conditions for the vessels they finance. It's more than just going on board and getting documents and saying, oh, they've got a lovely policy in place. It's actually focusing on talking to the crews in appropriate conditions. So if we can't talk to crew in private, there's no point in having a conversation with them.
Absolutely.
If we can't have an anonymous conversation with them in private, there's no point in doing it. Mm-hmm. Because if people don't feel safe, they're not going to say the bad stuff. If they think that they're not going to get their contract renewed because they spoke to us, they're not going to talk to us. They need the money. These guys are living in a world where they don't have a choice. The sad thing is the world says we've got a shortage of crew members, seafarers, yet there's some nationalities that can't get work, which I find interesting. But so the financial institutes are just one part of it. Other target customer are the shippers. So we, again, help them understand the problem, because in fairness to cargo owners, the likes of your big chains who import goods from China or Bangladesh and ship it all around the world to their shops here in Europe or there in the US, they don't actually know about this problem. It's been, no one pays it attention because crew members are stuck out at sea. And, you know, I'd put it out there that there's plenty of examples where the abuses occurring on board ships are far worse than the abuses occurring in some of the factories that we hear about in the news that work for big brand retailers.
Right. Yeah, there's a problem and it kind of goes under the radar often, right? If they think it's a unforeseen problem that's not going to affect them. But, you know, as consumers of these goods that we're receiving, how do we know which companies are upholding the highest levels of crew welfare? And like, what's our way of supporting those companies?
Well, at the moment, you know, there's no robust method to say company X is doing a good job. With all emerging sustainability or human rights topics, it's going to take time. Consumers need to start asking questions of their companies they buy products from. So they've started asking questions about the workers building the cell phones, iPhones in China.
Mm-hmm.
They've started asking questions about the people who make our clothes in Bangladesh, and it's improved.
Right.
It's not until the consumer asks more questions will there be a step change. The industry does not appear to have the ability to deal with it. There is no effective enforcement mechanism for this issue on the high seas. There's too many conflicts of interest, and that's one of the things Frank is absolutely adamant and passionate about. There is, the shipping world is self-policing. There's too many conflicts of interest. The agencies that are responsible for supposedly checking crew welfare standards have a conflict of interest. So your classification societies or your audit companies, they have big contracts. I mean, if you're – even your flag states and your classification societies, they need to attract members.
Mm-hmm.
If they are too hard, then the ship owner goes, well, actually, I'm going to go to another flag state and another – classification society.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's also an issue around, you know, on the other area that we help customers understand around, it's not seafarer welfare, but what happens to all our ships that at the end of the life, 70% of them end up on three beaches in South Asia. And that's a deadly job.
And those are horrendous working conditions.
Horrendous. And, you know, could you imagine, and your local delivery company, I'm not going to say brands, but we can all think of the little trucks that drive around our streets and our hometowns. Could you imagine if they drove their trucks onto the beaches and paid someone to dismantle them there with no controls? It would not be acceptable. Yet somehow we as a society, and this is not blaming any part of the chain, It's an issue that hasn't had the attention of consumers and shippers. It's not acceptable. There are exceptions on some of these beaches that are improving, but they are the exception. So it's just not acceptable in any modern consumer to have waste products or machinery or things dismantled on bare ground with, you know, very, very shoddy labor conditions, very little safety equipment. It's deadly. People, it's got an incredibly high
mortality
death rate.
Yeah.
Mortality rate. Workers get horrendously injured. There's no hospitals within reasonable distances of these yards. And it's improving, but still it's not good enough. And the only way for it to change, because the industry has allowed this to happen. The industry chose to start sending their ships to these beaches.
Right.
The US and the Europe had shipbreaking facilities in the past. They still do. But the industry saw this cheap, easy, ungoverned environment in Pakistan, in India, in Bangladesh, where they could get away with pretty questionable practices. And we as consumers need to pay for that. So if it's really about profit and they're not making any money, you never saw a poor ship owner. But hey, even if it's about that $5 million they save by scrapping it there, you know, $5 million over the course of the ship spread over however many shipping containers, it's nothing. So it's about if we as consumers are willing to pay for it and cargo owners, shippers were aware of the problem and were willing to pay for it, which I believe they would because it'd be minuscule per container, the problem would be gone. And it's not about not using these beaches. If they truly believe they can be brought up to EU standards, because if you're an EU ship owner and it's an EU flagged vessel, it can't be shipped broken on these beaches, but there's ways around that with reflagging and shell companies and so forth. But if you really want to do it, we could be putting some of those profits we're making into building hospitals, you know.
Oh, right. Protecting the people.
Imagine how much, yeah, just, you know, if you're truly being honest about it and you're saying, we believe that we are doing the right thing and we're developing this industry into a safe place. You know, the number of ships who save make 5 million euros or dollars more profit on each ship or more. Imagine if they took some of that, each ship, and put it into building a new hospital. They'd have 10 hospitals there within a week. That's a bit of exaggeration, but, you know, they've had time, but they're very, very slow to move. And the industry is very good now at responding to carbon emissions because the world's put focus on it. But up until recently, the shipping industry didn't put much in focus on carbon emissions.
Right. It's just become a hot topic recently. Yeah.
Yeah. It became a hot topic and they're spending a lot of time and money on it. But the consumer at the end will pay. That's fine.
So, Bryce, you started talking about shippers and their role in all of this, and we got a little distracted. So how can shippers address this issue?
So in our view, given there's such a lack of inability to enforce this in the global sense, the shippers and the freight forwarders hold the key or are a key part of this problem. A shipper, just like the financial institutes, can, when they're putting out and requesting tender documents or offers for services from shipping companies, they can assess the companies in their procurement process for human rights procedures and past track record, but that's a bit tough at the moment at the start of the process. But they can then impose conditions in the contracts that enforce minimum standards. Now, there's nothing wrong with the IMO minimum standards and the ILO minimum standards, but they're just not enforced, skirted around. The shipper has the power to negotiate into contracts clauses that allow them to insist on the minimum standards and audit them. So the shipper and the freight forwarder, and then have penalty clauses if they find abuses, or they can choose to work with a shipping company and work with them and help them understand what they need. Because if you get a few large companies who ship a lot of goods pulling out of certain shipping providers, then it's going to start making an impact. Just like they've made conversations around, you know, by 2030, 2040, we're going to be addressing CO2 emissions on board ships So big companies have the ability to change this, but also smaller companies in the smaller routes. And if they start asking questions and work with their suppliers, just like they work with the factories in China and Bangladesh and the coffee growers in South America, it's not about saying we're going to stop using you. It's one option, if there's a better option, but it's actually encouraging the shipping companies to do better. And then after some time, if they're still getting problems, then they can choose to use another provider. Really, really hard at the moment with the supply chain crisis and the Ukrainian war, the Russian war in Ukraine. Shippers don't have a lot of choice at the moment. And I totally get that. And so that's been one of our challenges, setting up this company, this service in the middle of the COVID and the supply chain crisis, now the war. But it takes time for even your company's head around this and understand the problem and start developing policies. Because if you try and do it without a policy, you're not going to achieve anything. So just like all your other human rights policies or environmental policies that you have to address in your supply chain, you need to have a firm policy that your procurement team understand and they know what they're trying to achieve when they're having negotiations or with shipping providers.
So Bryce, how do we make a difference here and what can we do to help? And more importantly and most importantly is where do we get more information if we want to educate ourselves better about this?
So if you're a shipper or you're a bank, you know, you could come to someone like me, but I think it's important actually to not go to consultants that are trying to sell you a product. It's actually better to inform yourself by yourself by reading the guidelines and understanding them. So reading the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights is a great start. It's a long document, but you can skim read it and pull out the key points. And then you can read the OECD Guidelines for Multinational Enterprises. And then there's a follow-on document called the OECD Due Diligence for Responsible Corporate Lending and Securities and Underwriting. Or, you know, just go online and search around. If you don't believe there's a problem in your supply chain, you actually don't need someone like me to prove it. There's so much evidence if you go digging online, if you just start talking about seafarer welfare, crew abuses, human rights abuses.
This is a really tough topic to talk about. I mean, it's not fun. Nobody wants to admit that there's issues with our supply chain and that we can't just go to the shelf and blindly pull off what we want and not acknowledge the human sacrifice that's involved in it. So, you know, thank you for bringing it up and being a voice for these people and shedding light on this problem. And I hope that we can find solutions. And I'm glad that you're bringing it to the forefront. And if people want to reach out to you, are you on LinkedIn? How should they reach out to you?
Yep. So you can check out our website, esgshipvetting.com. So vetting with two T's. esgshipvetting.com, or you can just look me up, Bryce Lawrence, on LinkedIn. Our logo's a swirly yellow and red round logo. And yeah, happy to have a conversation. You know, we're doing this as much about, we spent more time educating than making money. this is a raising awareness. And you know, Frank's not doing this to make lots of money. He's happy to make money. When he agreed to join me, it was about making a difference. And that's why I set this venture up, was to actually make a difference. I've been on the other end, and I think there needs to be more done for human rights in the whole supply chain. And I think, you know, what can we do, you know, with time, speak with your wallet. I know of a couple of suppliers that can, or retailers, but there's not many retailers can actually say, we don't have a problem in our maritime supply chain because no one is addressing it. If you're a shipper, if you don't want to work with someone in Europe, find a consultancy that's doing ESG or CSR and ask them. But the problem is, here's the thing. You know, I've talked to some companies and we're the only company in the world that we're aware of doing it quite like we are, where we're focusing, providing a service for the shipper or the bank, and we have no conflict of interest in the industry. And all the other sustainability consultants, this is a foreign concept to them. So I've challenged, well, we've done a risk assessment of our supply chain. This didn't come up. And I said, well, have they got any experience? Are they aware of the topic? And they said, well, I assume they do. And I said, well, you employed a generalist and you got a general answer. You got the bulk of the boxes ticked. You know, for some tasks, you've got to have a specialist who understands a problem. So we don't offer services the whole of supply chain. We just look at one tiny part and deliver specialist advice rather than trying to sell everything to everyone.
Yeah, that's wonderful to have a specialized view on this problem and trying to offer solutions. And I think that your mission aligns well with Women Offshore, that we're attempting to provide a safe place for all mariners and offshore workers to thrive and be successful and come home to their family safely. And so thank you for the services you're providing and the education that you gave us today. And I hope that we can all start bringing these conversations up to the forefront of, you know, these hard topics that not a lot of us want to talk about, but need to. And that's one thing that Women Offshore is good at, is having these tough conversations. So thanks for educating me. And I hope that we can continue this good work that you're doing.
Yeah, thank you for hosting me and giving me the opportunity to have a conversation about this topic.
Thank you, Bryce.